22.
Un fils.
Un homme. Deux jeunes filles. Deux heures.
I'm happy that we gave a good review to our customer. And second to 102 is a good
one. The tourists also seem to be enjoying themselves
enormously. Well, it's one of the most important customs of Japan. Something that we definitely must pass on to the succeeding generation.
What is this? It's so lively and the atmosphere is great.
Where is that from above? Where is dinner in the bowl? One man, one wife, one love, three lives, man, three times, day.
KTV memory.
Hello, this is Tim calling to say that 1991 will be the year of Bob, because we all know that 1991 is 1991 backwards, and so is Bob.
That the game's up. He said the international military force led by the United States may have to be used to free Kuwait. Robin?
A new angle emerged today in the investigation of the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration said it is looking into whether one of its couriers unintentionally helped with the bombing. Flight 103 was blown up over Lockerbie, Scotland, nearly 2 years ago. All 270 people aboard were killed. A pro-Iranian terrorist group was believed to be behind the attack. The DEA is now investigating whether one of its couriers working on a drug sting operation was tricked into carrying the bomb aboard.
Yes? Hey, how you doing? Listen, I was just reading the paper and it says, the headline says, here's Bob Ray again and again. And you know what's strange? It's sort of a drag, actually. The reporter said, he goes, well, you know, he's making all these appearances, and maybe he's going to become Burnout Bob. And then he, you know what he cites as an example of that? He goes, well, he started to cry when he was recounting the Holocaust. And I thought, fuck, check out the reporter. He must think that, like, no politician could actually, like, feel something. That's amazing. He just denies his capacity to be a human being. Bob Ray is speaking up, of course. And then I thought, it's too bad because Ontario should totally give the guy support and encouragement, you know, because the next 4 years, you know, here we can have a lot of input and, you know, say, look, the government's going to listen to us, and so we're going to give them input, which is probably a shocking thing since most people aren't used to that anymore. But it's interesting how, remember the Evergreens had said the provincial government will claim that unlike the federal government, we listen? Well, maybe the federal government knows that's going to happen, so they've tried to do a preemptive strike by bringing out that people's forum, citizens forum, because the guy said it's their orchestrating group therapy on the nation. So there you have it. It's like the last show you did, Bob. You know, you got the forums like a giant espionage event, you know, all the pollsters, information gathering, and the men all processing it together, and we'll have a nice report, and who knows what it'll do, but it'll certainly accomplish audience research. So, and it'll also get the idea, it'll preempt the Ray's claim that, you know, well, you know, we're really missing the people, the federal government, go, well, so are we. We're also gathering information. Hey, listen to this. U.S. President George Bush will fly to the Persian Gulf region later this month to share Thanksgiving turkey with American soldiers. The White House announced yesterday the visit to Egypt and Saudi Arabia on November 22nd. The U.S. thanks and giving, thanks, now we're good, will follow Bush's trip to Paris. for the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe, White House spokesman Martin Fitzwater said. Well, there you go, eh? The visit to Egypt and Saudi Arabia on November 22nd, the U.S. Thanksgiving, you know, thanks, thanking them and giving, you know, and then he goes to Paris first. I mean, if that's not a culmination of the last 30 years, and in particular the last 10 years, then everything else is also, which it is too. You know what I mean?
I am the head of the Center for Culture and Technology.
Wartime waits for no man. Bob, I checked out that reading you suggested in Volume 11, and it was fabulous, just fabulous. It really is a revitalization of visual space. And I interspersed that with little snippets from Take Today. And somehow I just knew I was going to come across a mouse when I sat down to do my reading. So, get out of here, you mean old owl. Aye, old hag, I'm not as scared of you. And, World War III. No division between civil and military fronts. CSP, Iron Age, eh?
Physical guarantees, physical guarantees.
For the spiritual master of heart, that is within the life, the nature of heart, the nature of heart, the essence of your personality, spiritual heart. That inner person, the person that is your heart.
Your relationship there now is real tonight.
Seat in the center of all life. This I can guarantee for the hearts that are given in the life. Guarantee that if you will let Jesus Christ take control of the center of you, then everything can be new.
Over there. Over there. Not here, but over there.
Hey, Bob, it's Guelph calling. Here's a couple of poems I wrote recently. First one's called Haiku. Reading LaRouche, recovering my Western bias. And the second one is called The Secrets of the Inner Elites. We're at the Metro Library on the third floor, photocopying everything in sight from issues of a magazine called The Campaigner, and I feel like we're the only people there, not wasting our time.
Welcome back, Bob.
Praise Bob.
Welcome back yourself, Doug.
Thank you, Bob.
Get right to it. Jay Glickman. And Doug Nicholson and Philip Ower. This is the Bond Street Gallery. I had to go because it's 122 Bond Street. All right? Doug and his buddies had a show. I would deal with Jay first. His show was called, this is a photographic show. His show was called The Magic Carpet. All right? And noticing some of the quotes he juxtaposed with the pictures, one of them points out that, quote, on the fault line between fixity and mobility. Remember that, Doug?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, fixity, obviously, Gutenberg Galaxy, visual space, right? Mobility, well, you could have external mobility that comes through the movie medium, the outer trip, kinetic mobility, and also with radio and TV, you have psychic mobility, the discarnate experience. But that's not necessarily moving. When you're using radio and TV, you're not moving anywhere like you are with the movie medium. With television, you're on the inner trip, not an outer trip, and therefore you're just resonating and working with modulations in the same spot as everybody else. But you're still going somewheres, in effect, with the movie medium. So the theme that Jay Glickman seems to evoke here is the fault line. What is the fault line between fixity and mobility? All right, I would say between visual space and the movie medium, kinetic space. Mobility, what's in between? Well, he calls the fault line, and I think he is hoiking up the photograph as the fault line. Now, the fault line implies linear visual space, kind of static state, something like fixity, but not fixity, not approaching mobility.
Well, a fault line is something that is fixed at the moment, but will move.
It's right, yeah, because his follow-up statement under another picture photograph is, the character is a grounded man still shaking. Grounded Man, Still Shaking, I think it was written under the photos. So, yeah, that the photo is the medium between fixity and mobility. It's shaky, especially inside electric ground. You can ground yourself iconically with the photograph, basically post-alphabetic, dealing with facial gestures. The photograph created the interest in Freud, profiles of psychic gesture. All right? So,
and the ability to remove a gesture from its context and becomes psychopossessive or obsessive.
That's right.
Of a gesture and just parts of the body.
Right. And it's linear in a sense. It's fixed. It's static. But it's not alphabetic. It's not abstract space. It's a gestural space. So I would say Glickman scores with an accurate portrayal of the movie medium there, using the phrase fault line, since he qualifies later on with the phrase grounded man temporarily has a role of the photographer, right? Mm-hmm. But shaking and still shaken because the electric environment is a swirl the photographic exhibit takes place in, right? So not mm-hmm. bad for Glickman. Deal with Philip, what's his
Ower.
Name? Philip Ower. His show, more of a personal romantic of fetish. The only the quote that I took interest in was he quoted some writer who would be famous at the end of the century or famous as the pinnacle of his work with the quote that people are more and more dreaming awake. Mm-hmm. Or rather, he says, are going about their waking life or daily lives in a dream. Yeah, that was the quote. We're going about our daily lives in a dream. Now, why I'm interested in that is that under electric conditions, we are dreaming awake. Now, the movie medium is the dreaming awake. Mm-hmm. In particular, when the movie medium came in, you had dreams that money could buy, and therefore you were dreaming awake. Now, that was the beginning. It was the borderline between the visual space and the tactile electric space, the movie medium, kinetic. So you're starting to get that trance state of the average citizen, but it's not the same as the electric sense. I'd say that dreaming awake in the movie medium is more matching with an external environment. When you're dreaming awake and once you're into the radio and television environment, especially TV, where you're making an image out of the mosaic mesh of the TV and your computer screen, then you're making a reality. You're making sense rather than matching with sense. So not bad for Philip to say, to point out that not the photo, but the movie medium is a speeded up photo. So I don't know, Phil, he didn't qualify the states of dreaming awake too concretely, so we'll have to give him a B on that, all right? As opposed to Jay Glickman's A. And the third demonstration of photographic skill was the Doug across from me. But not electrically. We're in the same space right now. But from my point of view, physically, no one can experience me seeing you now. Mm-hmm. They just experience you in the same space they're in, the listeners, right? But for you, you're across from me, as well as being discarnate with
me. I'm around them.
You're around them, that's right. And
does that mean they're inside me?
Yes. Oh, yeah, the electric space is inside and outside. You know, it's both.
Mm-hmm.
Interpenetrating is a key word. Interpenetrating. No boundaries, no walls. And this photographic exhibit is an attempt to use an old medium to prop up a wall of identity as a role for the artists here. And they seem to be quite aware of the fragility and...
my photographs?
No, I'm not talking about you. I'm still talking about all of them.
Okay.
Just using the photograph medium, they're aware of the fragility of that medium. And by you in particular, your photographs... the quote that was juxtaposed with them, I think it was from John Berger, was something about Adams and Eve's daily going out, moving around.
Well, it's Adam and Eve continually expelled from the garden and with what tenacity returning at night.
Right. So every day is a new day under electric conditions. Since there's no boundaries, then we have to use the calendar as a guideline to indicate that this moment is different from the other 24-hour cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And we use that as a trigger to the point to suggest to ourselves that today has nothing to do with what went yesterday. Even though we live in an electric environment that retrieves all moments, so you can't escape the past or the future. But we ferociously every day go out and try to make a new day for ourselves, like living on the frontier where we get to forge a new identity, new role every day. So every day you're creating new Adams and Eves as this kind of man goes out about his situation and role-playing, right, in the solar theater. And then he has to confront his the changes and and the soaking, sudsing, and rinsing of his identity daily. And then he goes back home to security. So the Adams and Eves return back to their nest, and that is because the major media archetypes are animals that eat us alive. They're cannibalistic, so this will create a renewed interest over the long run in conservative marriage kind of security. So you're pointing out that we return to our what do you call it? Our one-on-one relationships, whatever form they take,
mm-hmm.
as
and our bodies.
Okay. And our bodies, right. Return to our bodies as an archetypal experience. It's all, even though it's surrounded by hell, the Garden of Eden appears to penetrate one's domestic zone, right?
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of the quality of it. Because that nightly security is needed. The security of returning to your own personal bunker. So, yeah, Adams and Eve's a good quote. And
there was a quote at the end, too.
Yeah, I have noted there. Let's just see. It was, don't understand me. Too easily and too soon.
No, it is as if one could be understood too easily or too soon by Leslie Fiedler.
Yeah, like, and see Fiedler's no POB, right? Pre-narrated bastard. So he thinks that
Well, it's from an essay called On Freshman Comp when he's explaining I think it was 1938. He was in one of the universities in New York, it might have been NYU,
yeah.
Taking, and there was a course they had to take in their freshman year on compass, how to compose. And it was sort of a...
The problems he had with the teacher?
The problem was what he had with the teacher, but also how it was unfortunate that the teacher had to teach this course, which, because the teacher was not a professor, he was a master's student, or a PhD student.
Yeah.
So...
Okay, so the thing is that he's saying don't match with me too quickly.
Mm-hmm.
But being a POB, he is raising the matching experience as a significant experience.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying it takes time to understand one or him. You can't do it too easily and too soon, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he's putting a kind of precious quality on his matching desires,
mm-hmm.
right? But a world of making was going on all around him in 1938, which was wiping out the POB reality
with
the radio environment, and it was Finnegan's Wake at that point, 1938.
Is that when that was published?
Well, it came out in 1939, but it was written from 1922 to 1939, but he was describing the effect of
mm-hmm.
of radio on Europe and the world,
and
we're going into pain and suffering of World War II.
Now, it wasn't just, was it radio or electronic distribution of the human voice?
Oh, radio was the ground. See, electricity is a biological event. When the telegraph arrived as an environment by 1850, that pushed man into a new dimension. So every electric environment since then has been a refinement of frequency modulation of the biological event of moving into a new biology. We were wearing new apparatus.
The only reason I'm thinking of not just radio, but electronic projection of the voice was Hitler's quote that he never would have conquered Germany without the loudspeaker.
Well, the voice is important in the sense that he didn't read his text over the air. He screamed and bellowed,
mm-hmm.
and therefore created he resonated well in his voice with the echo chamber effect of the radio environment. So the radio environment created a well of loneliness for cultures,
mm-hmm.
and identity crisis. So the fact that he bellowed emotionally and evoked the tribal dreams of the past of Germany was the reason for the power and hypnotic effect of his voice.
Mm-hmm.
It worked within the radio environment and the loudspeaker environment.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, he had movie media and car media as well.
Mm-hmm.
But the major new environment was radio, which was quite invisible to people in its effects. And that's why... you know, once by the 50s, the people engaged in World War II looked back and wondered if they had gone mad, you know, on all levels.
Especially. They still wonder, yeah.
Now they're wondering if the TV environment drove them mad. And we're just out of it. So we're just out of that environment. Your photos were more on a personal level. Why was the black and white? Why not color?
I worked mostly in black and white. I'm starting to work more in color. And... black and white for me is the more full expression at the moment.
Well, this show is going till the 16th, so anybody wants to drop into 122 Bond Street, right parallel to Victoria Street, and see my co-host, my deadpan ghost host.
I'm only deadpan when I'm here, Bob, because I have to provide the ground for you to jump on.
That's right. Yeah, and Mike was described as that in some article. So it goes to November 16th, and you want to see what was I going to say? What Doug, Jane, Philip are projecting through the photographic medium? There was something about what you. In your pictures show people in isolation, which is the daily discarnate battle. Electric autonomy is what your Adams and Eves go through in the daily grind, and I think that comes through in your photos. And it's implied to go back to a nested relationship in some form.
And I mean, one also thing in my photographs is sexuality and sensuality in the body and in the person.
Oh, I know nothing about that.
I know, Bob. You know nothing about
that. I didn't pick
that.
Up that.
No?
No, I'm too busy using my senses
I know.
To meditate on them.
All your chakras are always shaken.
Yeah, I'm so sensual and sexual and daily that it's an invisible environment. It's an invisible environment, so I couldn't really speculate on that. I just am that.
That's okay.
You know, and Doug, you know, you're young, not getting that much, so you can have time to speculate on it, right, Doug?
Exactly, Bob.
Yeah. So good work, guys, and I'm surprising, Doug, you didn't know if I'd go, but I went and didn't tell him I would talk about this, so Doug did fine on the spot. But I hope those people that aren't interested in Doug's photos stay with us, and now we get into some good stuff.
Okay, Bob.
Good stuff.
I'm glad to be back. Mike is away on business, I guess, business and pleasure simultaneously in the nation's capital, as the other nation's capital.
Our capital,
no doubt, yes. So we have a CIA plant is the prime minister, which I think about the second or third last time I was here, we established that.
We
prepare for imminent war. And got a couple of new Federalists today. One of the headlines on
LaRouche's newspaper.
LaRouche's newspaper. And one of the headlines on the front page of, I think, the latest one said that that Henry Kissinger is orchestrating this to take over the Saudis' oil fields.
That's exactly what, that's true. That's right, according to my sources, which are independent of LaRouche's. We now can see why we had the Meech Lake fiasco so the Canadians could get used to the idea there was no Canada anymore, because Joe Clark is no longer hoiking up the traditional Canadian image of peacemaker. We're now fully integrated with Washington. we're war-making with the best of them now, right?
Exactly.
That was the purpose of the Meech Lake fiasco this summer.
And also, I mean, sticking to more current events, Margaret Thatcher, by this time next week, might be out of her job.
Oh, what's the news on that? The by-election?
Heseltine has said that next week he will contest her leadership, and if a majority of the...
Oh, they got a conference, a convention? Come on.
I guess. They didn't really understand in what context it was going to happen, but I guess something's going to happen. There's going to be a vote, and if she does not win a majority... And she will not be head of the Conservative Party, and that makes her not head of, or makes her not Prime Minister.
Well, I remember...
But there's a whole big thing about whether Heseltine will actually take over, and...
Remember, he was booted out 3 or 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm, under a scam of some helicopter scam scandal.
But the thing I remember, LaRouche predicted a year or so ago that the forces were lining up against Margaret Thatcher.
But she's also using the Iraqi... the Middle East crisis as a way for her and Bush and the Anglo-Americans and the oligarchs to take over the oil fields, Bob.
That's right. I mean, see, basically, not bad, Doug. Basically, Doug's just cheering his own, exposition there, congratulating himself. He managed to say a sentence quite eloquently. And the thing is that it's basically, the Anglo-American against the new European fortress. So you see the ones who want to work with the European fortress are not keen on going to war.
If the Anglo-Americans can get this oil, then they can play games with the German and Japanese economy till the Lederhosen come home.
Yeah, so Thatcher's working for America on that level, and but the European fortress is pretty strong, and they can knock her off.
Well, that's what Heseltine is pro-European. I mean, Thatcher is against a common currency and against those funny people on the continent, I guess.
Well,
and Heseltine is for them, as is Sir Geoffrey Howe. And there's a connection where I guess the House of Windsor are going to win no matter who wins.
That's right, Doug. You got to get into the Herbert W. Armstrong office there to understand the battle between Europe as the retrieval of Assyria, the ancient Assyrian Empire, against the United States and Britain as the Ephraim and Manasseh, the lost tribes of Israel. So the lost tribes of Israel are feeling a little out of it, but the Queen's confident because she's got the throne of David, the line of David in her blood, the Holy Blood, Holy Grail. So They might be able to make the leap with Europe.
Now, is she part of the line from the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail?
Yeah, that's the claim of Herbert W. Armstrong.
But it's not just her.
The bloodline. He went with, Joseph took the bloodline to Ireland and, you know, back mm-hmm. there, what, 0 A.D.? No, yeah. 35 A.D.
35.
and then it worked through Ireland into Scotland and down in England. So they've been protecting a lot of the bloodline there. And, of course, it was the British journalists who promoted the Holy Blood, Holy Grail myth in the 80s.
In that
ready.
Book.
Yeah. And they talk about the bloodline theory of the British crown, and they emphasize the prior Zion, but the British crown is there, and we're watching Prince Charles rise on
the speaking of crowns and princes, I think we had a new king crowned this week. It was on Tuesday, I believe, Monday or Tuesday.
Oh, yeah, the Japanese. Oh, as the Exorcist have pointed out, the Japanese mafia is going to be very powerful in 100 years. They're a contender. I mean, the Chinese groups aren't that strong, but at the end of the 21st century, look
at the Japanese mafia.
The Japanese oligarchy, mafia, whatever you want to call it, they are going to be very strong.
The tattooed guys.
Yeah, they're going to be very strong in 100 years, and they're keen on hoiking up their oligarchy. Everybody had to be at that conference.
Everybody, and even parts of the coronation were not allowed to be seen by anyone but His Royal Highness and the Shinto priests, some of whom I believe were female as well, which I'm not sure how the hierarchy is in Shintoism.
Right, but it's the Gnostic Babel of keeping the mystery of Babylon, or the mystery of Babel. The Gnostic legacy is based on keeping a secret, keeping something separate, a division between spirit and matter, and the oligarchy, the priest represents spirit as opposed to matter, and this, of course, is the agenda that LaRouche is angry about, and he does not believe there's a division between spirit and matter, and he believes matter is spirit. And there's no difference between objectivity and subjectivity, but anybody who makes a line between spirit and matter falls into the Gnostic zone, and the oligarchs rely on that.
Any significance to this coronation coming so close after Remembrance Day?
What was the coronation, Tuesday or Wednesday? November
it was
the 12th.
It was Tuesday there.
That's the 13th.
That's the 13th.
Yeah, Remembrance Day is 11-11. Well, that's that's very significant. 11-12, okay, which is 1-2-2.
Which was, the coronation would have been 11-13.
You mean moving it in?
11-12 here.
Yeah, 11 yeah. For us is what's important, yeah. From Bob's point of view, Doug.
Okay,
so you're talking 11, November is 11, 12 uh-huh. days, so you got 1-1-1-2, so you take two of the ones and make it two, so you got 122, which was the address of your gallery, and it's the address of mm-hmm. Dobstown. So I think we consider it the anti-Bob forces, eh? 122, coming out of the east.
Yeah.
Why were we talking about this?
Talking about Margaret Thatcher.
Oh, yeah, just your observations, doing your homework. All right,
I had more homework.
Hold it.
Okay.
I mean, I think they get bored of, they're used to
chatter?
Yeah, because the church
They want to be brought in.
Yeah, we got any phone? Don't take any yet. But,
okay, I just want, what numbers are we still using?
595-1478 for sharing in your discarding experience with Bob and Doug. It's important that Bob and Doug is here that Doug is here tonight, because we're going to do a little thing here before we take calls, but we're hoping that we haven't alienated anybody. We're ready to share the discarding experience. We got all night long. Mike ain't here. We can cover a lot of territory without the pressures of Mike and his time sense and his sense of mainstream PR abilities. You know, I don't know what he has. He has a sense of something that we sometimes...
And we love it.
Yeah, and we have to go along with it. But we're getting a break on November 14th. Note this is the 14th number. We got a call, but...
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's take a call. Let's see how Doug can handle this.
Okay. Are you there, caller? Okay. Oh, just a second, caller. Okay, you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Great, great. Okay.
Is Bob there?
Bob is here.
Hi, Bob. It's Sean.
Okay, Sean. Are you continuing from 2 weeks ago?
Pardon?
Are you continuing your topic from 2 weeks ago, or do you have some new stuff?
What was my topic 2 weeks ago? We were performing a touch-out on the AIDS cure.
Yeah, you were late.
But you
brought up some interesting points about... press conferences and Bob using different media to express himself, not as a press conference, but to share different shapes of Bob in different media.
Mm-hmm. I remember that. Now, I wanted to comment about the Gnostics using the secrets.
Yeah.
That's why all the Gnostic groups are coming out in the open, because they can't keep any more secrets.
Yeah, that's right. It's obsolete, so it works.
Yeah.
You know, so everybody will be a Gnostic. Everybody will form a little tribal cult, right?
Yeah, that's why. Yeah, because you've got all these secret cults all over the place. I mean, they're chirping over each other now.
Yeah, and that's because they think the private citadel of consciousness has to be kept in a private zone. They don't know They don't know that the private state of consciousness is transparent. If you don't understand that, then you want to hide it. And the way you hide it is in some cultish babble.
Yeah, and that's why you have to keep printing books and stuff.
Or any medium.
Yeah. Because, every secret's out in the open now. Espionage is a big topic, even in the news.
Well, you know, you just mentioned that they keep printing books. That's a good point. Gnosticism does come out of visual space. There's a different kind of Gnosticism in the West than in the East. And so in terms of the Western dynamic here, yeah, the people would use Gnostic concepts to hoik up visual space and give a reason to print a book, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Those guys who wrote the Holy Blood and the Holy Grail, they just came out with their new one, The Temple and the Lodge.
The Temple and the Lodge, yeah. They did Messianic Legacy, and then they got a new one out.
Yeah, they got a new one
what
out.
What are they saying that?
Pardon?
What do they talk about there?
I haven't read it yet. I just saw it.
I think The Temple and the Lodge, that goes into Solomon's Temple, right? And
I think it's just about basic Masonic practices.
Well, the temple is really...
It's not a continuation on the old books that they wrote about.
It's more Masonic.
It's more centering on just general Masonic.
Well, the Masonic tradition came out of the Knights Templar, which was based on the Crusades in, 1000s and 1100s.
Mm-hmm.
And they wanted to rebuild Solomon's Temple, all right?
Yeah.
The Third Temple. And so Rosicrucianism and the Masonic Order is based on the temple builders. So the Knights Templars were expelled from the Catholic Church around 1300 and something, and then they lodged themselves up in Scotland, and from there they used Robert the Bruce, or Robert Bruce. The Bruce, Doug? Robert the Bruce.
Robert. It was Robert the Bruce.
Yeah, Robert the Bruce and his gang then used Scotland, a primitive place at that point, to take over the British crown, and they succeeded with the ouster of Queen Elizabeth in the end, and put in Queen Elizabeth I, and then put in the James Stuart line, okay? So that's when the Cecils and the Rosicrucian gang took over the British oligarchy from Scotland and the Knights Templar tradition. And then you then connect that with the Temple Mount movement in Israel now. The Jewish fundamentalists are very keen on putting up the Third Temple of Solomon, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we had the Temple Mount, problem on October 8th between the Arabs and the Israelis over praying at the temple site, right? And
yeah.
The Arabs do not want the Dome of the Rock replaced with the Solomon's Temple movement.
So, I had a question about the British hierarchy. If the Queen's pushing drugs, right, and if they're into the international drug traffic, doesn't that tie them down with the Masonic cults down in Italy, like the P2 groups and stuff?
Okay, my headphone fell off. Just say that sentence again, accurately, exactly.
Okay, if the British hierarchy, like the Queen is pushing drugs...
No, she's not pushing drugs. She's not pushing drugs.
What's she pushing?
She's pushing the electronic condition, which allows the drug money to be laundered all over the planet. She's not interested in stopping it.
So the P2 then, what are they doing? They're just picking up on that and using the old form of pushing drugs to get everyone used to the electric environment?
That's a good point, in the sense that the electric environment causes drug taking.
Yeah.
They're just taking advantage of the Western societies, which are very addicted to the inner trip, the electric circuit condition, so drug trafficking, drug consuming is normal in the West,
yeah.
And they use that extreme software condition to bring in a religious bureaucracy, a temple bureaucracy versus the old hardware military bureaucracy.
Yeah.
The P2 is Catholic, all right, a Roman Catholic Church, and some people overlap the P2 with the Freemasonic Society, the head of it being the Duke of Kent.
Yeah, but apparently they're not connected, are they?
No, if you believe Herbert W. Armstrong and some other people, there was a serious battle going on between the Queen's Church and Pope John Paul II's Church. So
yeah.
Whether they unite or not is a key point that's going to be determined. Well,
the PRA was against the P2.
Who?
The Prior Age of Zion.
Yeah, Prior Age of Zion, which therefore they would be hooked more into the
British.
The British, because remember, the Prior Age of Zion is St. Clair, and what was the other family? Anyways, the St. Clair group have castles in England and Scotland.
It would make sense for
Doug wants to interject here.
I was going to say, isn't one of the present Queen's cousins head of the Knights of Columbus as well?
Is that Catholic?
Knights of Columbus is, yes.
Maybe, because they may overlap. See, this is the interesting thing. Is Herbert W. Armstrong correct, saying there's a real division between the lost tribes of Israel in England and Europe? You know, is there a real division there that's going to have to work out? Because this is serious stuff for the aristocratic oligarchs. This is their history, you know, their battles, their wounds.
Their reason for existing.
Yeah, their wounds from 500, 700 years ago. So this division between Europe and Britain is a real complicated issue. And I think we should just talk about the divisions as terms of what's going to happen. Depends on what kind of flack I get on the council. Because one of the key players on the Secret Council 10 is Johannes Turnin-Taxis, the German oligarch. And I have to deal with him and Prince Charles.
The one responsible for the death of Andy Warhol.
Doug, you said that.
It would make sense for the Masons to push drugs because, like, they want to clean up the planet and get one world government going so they can go on, right? And start working people towards the solar government, right? So
okay.
The best way to do that.
Wait. Have you heard the Axis press conference on the conspiracy from 1400 to 2000?
No, I haven't.
Okay, in that, you see, the oligarchs were powerful till 1914, the ancient noble oligarchs.
Yeah.
And then from 1920s till 1983, the Western governments became the new oligarchs and ran the planet through their foreign aid and things like that. All right, so from that 60-year period, the old oligarchs, the noble oligarchs, were floating and in disarray. And maybe that's why King Edward VIII, you know, he became the Duke of Windsor. Because he had to abdicate, supposedly over being married to an American commoner, but
she had been divorced twice.
That was the angle. Okay, so the problem was that he really was showing a strong alliance with the Nazis. Now his insecurity by the 30s over their position, since the government Keynesian oligarchs, the nouveau oligarchs, were taken over. The old oligarchs were a bit strapped for maybe cash flow, so they might have started getting involved with the Nazi element and the fascist element and the drug-pushing element, and apparently the Catholic Church did that through the rat line, which P2 people were involved in. So both European and British oligarchs were weakened in that period and therefore got a bit evil, right? Even though their own power structure may have been built on dope dealing in the opium wars, you know, back in the 19th century. But taking the 20th century situation where they were in a crisis and didn't have control of the switchboard from 1930 to 1982, then they would have built this up. Now the electric environment absorbs any wealth and evaporates it, erodes it under electric conditions. So the governments found themselves bankrupt by 1982. And they also had been... they had a lot of debt involvement with their network around the world, whereas the old oligarchs never invested and never lent money. They invested, so therefore they always had a profit margin, right? They always had profit, so they were happy to discover in 83-84 that they had the only gold and cash reserves around because of the erosion of the government oligarchs' power structure, wealth structure, all right?
Mm-hmm.
Wealth reserves. So if they have that, then maybe they don't need to use the dope incorporated networks anymore because they have got the basic gold.
But if they had any sense, they'd start using the tetrads like Gorbachev is doing. Because if you can control the medium and know where that's going to push people, then you can direct them where you want to.
Well, see, that's a key question, is how much is Gorbachev beholden to the European oligarchs? Because the Axis told us much of the oligarchic, noble oligarchic money is going into Eastern Europe, so they're going to lock up that. And Gorbachev had to make his peace with the Vatican, which represents a lot of the old noble oligarchs in Europe. So maybe...
So you're going to have to fire him?
That's a good... Another important statement. See, this Sean guy is, he's a perceptive guy. So I wouldn't be able to say that on the air, but I ain't firing him yet.
Yeah, you'll keep him on for a while.
Yeah, because the...
You know what I was thinking of? The tetrad itself would have to, as a technology, you could perform a tetrad on a tetrad. Because what it's done is it's given us control over mediums, right? So that mediums no longer... control our perceptions.
When you say mediums, you say plural media.
Media, yeah. So it no longer controls us. We control it. That turns around everything that McLuhan's taught for for most of his career.
No.
Because he's saying that people are walking around as somnambulists, but if you're aware of what they're doing, then you're no longer somnambulist.
Yeah, but there's no we in this situation. It's the only inhabitants of the solar theater are the animal archetypes, the media archetypes.
Mm-hmm.
And you're saying that man can control them through media ecology?
Mm-hmm. So you have media ecology, right? Okay, put it in terms of this, that any technology that comes out now from this point on can no longer be considered an accident in that it would be predicted beforehand that what the effect would be. Using media ecology, you no longer have the effect of, say, what happened with radio or what happened with TV where everyone was caught off guard. Now it's being set up so that any technology that comes out now, like, say, the high-definition TV, right, you can't consider that an accident.
All right, so I would say that the pink version, which Doug across from me was one of the first people to point out when we talked about media ecology, I think on July 11th, Doug, I was talking about media ecology, and he said, well, that's the pink version of media ecology. The pink version of media ecology is designed to keep people asleep, all right? I mean, they want to take advantage of the somnambulistic, unaware state that the users of the high-definition TV will get into, all right? They want to keep ahead of that.
But you see, you can't keep any secrets anymore, so everyone's going to know what a tetra is, and they'll know what's going on.
Well, you're talking about the effect of me, you know, my alternative subgenius media ecology, which has no secrets. But there are secrets being used by the pinks.
But how can they can't keep it, though.
Yeah.
I mean, we're all conducting espionage. We know what they're doing.
Well, if you're in touch with me, but the thing is that what do you mean by secrets? The puny secrets are allowed to be revealed. Major ones are protected by public incredulity. So I don't see any real secrets being revealed other than on my show in terms of what the oligarchs are using. They're using the secret consultations.
Okay, under electric technology, though, don't even the big secrets, you can't even hide the big secrets. I mean, before you didn't hide the big secrets because no one believes them. You only hid small secrets, but all the small secrets, right? It's the fact is that information is obsolete, right?
Information.
So even the big secrets are no longer secrets anymore. We all know what's going on.
No. See, the big secrets are the environmental effects themselves. For example, right now there's a felt need to return to human scale, but it's more like a solar theater scale, as we've said before. Now, that need is there as a somnambulistic response to the phases we've gotten to right now with the excessive speed of light transformation of all the mixed corporate media. Okay, we're post-TV, post-satellite, post-computer in our mood. All right, now the pink media ecologists can take advantage of that mood, which they're pumping into the people now with the environmentalist movement as
but
a general.
How can you have a pink agenda of media ecology when that's like trying to hijack the electric environment? It can't be done.
No. See, the electric animals, the electric archetypes, and the interplay have known effects. And if you don't want to tell people that they are living in certain environments, you manipulate those hidden grounds. Now, there is a problem for the oligarchs over the long run. That's why I will eventually rule in the sense of subgenius success and truth and light and no secrets, because the erosion of the pink version of media ecology, what you're getting at, is inevitable. But you're implying that that's happened already. It's not happened on a huge scale. It's only being talked about by people here in our show.
So we're acting again as the antenna.
Yeah, we're the anti-environment. We at this point an ersatz, fake anti-environment, but we will become a real anti-environment as we move through the year 1991, as one of the callers predicted.
Mm-hmm.
So what the problem is that is you have to offer remedies to people as they become aware of the fact there are no role-playing identities or secrets they can hide behind. I mean, look at the pinks among us. Like, was it you brought up all the cults? Yeah, you brought up you've got all these people hoiking up Gnostic cults as a reaction to the fact they don't want to face.
One's trying to get into the cults now.
Yeah, now this is why, as the oligarchs say, or the exes say in their in the press conference on September 26th about the history of the conspiracy, that the new mandate of the P2 and that is to realize that human resources are the greatest resources. So you're going to have the participation mystique take over. Everybody's going to be allowed to move in and be appendages to the various media bureaucracies.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right, and media environments. So they're going to welcome people in. This is what the Eastern Europe wanted to get involved in. They wanted the walls go down so they could have global theater mobility. Mm-hmm. All right, so they can participate.
So it's like
the participation thing is the addiction.
Yeah, it's the old participation slogan in Ontario.
And look at the pink image. They talk about jogging.
Yeah.
What was I saying?
You don't have a body, so they got it all wrong again.
Yeah, I was talking about some other kind of jogging. I can't remember what it was. It's in the archives 2 weeks ago. Did you hear that? Do we remember talking about jogging?
No, I wasn't around for that part.
Okay, so I said, whatever it was, you jog people's sensibilities by environmental interplay, right?
Yeah.
Are you talking to somebody?
Yeah, I was just asking Brent something. But go on, I was listening.
Oh, yeah, so we jog people's sensibilities with the unforeseen effects. Now, the point is that the pinks are still managing media ecology with a content orientation because they want to hog the major media as imagery, as image warfare, right?
Mm-hmm.
As icons. So the fact that they are several steps ahead of the general awareness on the planet allows them to use that. But as you see,
it'll be short termed at best.
Yeah, as long
they can't keep, because that interval between what they know and what we know is getting shorter and shorter, right? Like it's decreasing in size, the interval.
Well, that means they're catching up to me?
It means that the pinks can't use what they know for very long. I mean, it only lasts for a short period of time.
They can't rely on that many somnambulists to be fooled by them.
Yeah, because the somnambulists are catching up to them so fast.
They're catching up to us.
To the pinks.
No, the somnambulists are catching up to our awareness.
Yeah, I guess.
So they see through the pink screen.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, the oligarchs can't use any secrets they have, like the ones that we haven't, that the somnambulists haven't figured out yet.
Yeah. So you see, that's the fact that I already rule, and as the people become more aware of it, that'll be the state you're talking about. They get closer to seeing through the fake pink media ecology.
Yeah.
For example, they'll see through the environmentalist movement, you know, as an old rearview mirror image. It's like participation, which dealt with the old body, and now the content consensus is around the earth body we're supposed to be all wearing and protecting, right?
Yeah.
When we know that body has been long dissolved.
And then when they head out to Mars, then they'll start be worrying about the solar body.
When you say they head out tomorrow?
Mars.
Yeah, they'll be working for the solar government.
Yeah.
Did we clear this? I don't know. I'd like to just review that for a second. What do you think, Doug? Did we make sense with Sean? Did he make his points answered?
I think we covered it all, and we certainly covered it. And I think
I'm sure other people want to call through. I'm hogging the lawn here.
Well, Sean, have you been watching Twin Peaks?
No, I don't have a TV.
Oh, okay.
I don't watch TV anyways.
All right. Well, that was. What you just talked with me, did you want to discuss that before, between the two weeks ago?
No, I was just thinking picking about that up from what you were saying about the Gnostic cult and the rest of the
Yeah, right.
Along.
Well, the cult of the East, the Gnosticism, and the cult of the West, science, are two cults that are going to be used as brown paper bags for people.
Mm-hmm.
And art is another brown paper bag, so understanding...
So does that mean that, do you remember that comedian back in the 70s? He used to wear a paper bag over his head.
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder if he's going to come back as it hoiked up as an old archetype to let people relate to what's going on.
Oh, the Unknown Comic.
The Gong Show, yeah. The Gong Show and the Unknown Comic.
Well, he was just replaying some of Beckett's and Ionesco's dynamics in their theater, which were featured impersonal people, you know, bags over the heads, people who had no bodies, just costume as role.
Yeah.
Right? And, I don't know. I don't know if I fully explained what I mean, but...
So maybe in the 90s are going to be a big costume party.
No, it's been a costume party.
It's been a costume
party
since already.
The Halloween mask of the media archetypes as vortexes of energy has been what happening since 1945.
Yeah.
That's the theater.
So now, if you want a lot of people to participate, right, you give them all TV stations, right? Because remember, you use Xerox to make everyone a publisher, right?
Yeah.
So if you hand out everyone a TV set, which is, you know, that... America's Funniest Home Videos, right?
Yeah.
Everyone gets on TV, so it's all sort of participation there.
Right.
So
that's the myth. That's the myth of participation, and the electric media gives the best sense of mythic participation.
Mm-hmm.
But there's other formats and other modalities and other sensory biases that people need, too.
And there's another caller.
And we have another caller, Sean.
I'll let you guys go now.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead, you're on.
Bob?
Yeah.
Tim.
Tim?
Yeah.
Did you leave a couple of messages?
Yep.
Yeah, which one?
The one about Elvis and the one about next year.
Elvis?
Elvis.
Let's see. Did you do Lesson 22?
Which one? No, no.
The first one we played tonight?
No.
Memories, Man and Wife?
No.
And 1991?
Yeah.
Yeah, you did the 1991, right. Yeah, I know, Tim. All right. But the Elvis, what was that?
Well, that's part of my calendar. That's part of the Church of Elvis, whatever.
Right, but what message had Elvis in it?
Oh, that was the next day.
Entertainer becomes an idol?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, right. That was on, I think, last show?
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead, Tim.
Anyway, I was watching Twin Peaks last week, and there was a significant scene of Laura's mother, played by Piper Laurie, crawling down the stairs.
Yeah.
And then she has a vision of a white horse, and I was just wondering what you think the white horse is supposed to represent.
Well, one way to take the horse is it's the present by Ben Horn to Laura. She got a horse from her father for her birthday, but then she found out it actually was supplied by Ben, but it was a brown or reddish horse. And that's one way. There's something about the history of the Horns with the Palmers, and there's a horse element there, right?
Yeah.
And then also it could be her own, Mrs. Palmer's own horse, okay, her own horse fantasy, which may be common to people out there in Montana, Seattle area, right? And then other people think that horse is a pun on heroin, and that she was on heroin at that point. Do you follow that?
Yeah.
You believe that?
I have the idea that the white horse is like supposed to, it could either represent a knight in shining armor or death.
Yeah, what, one of the four horsemen. Which one was white?
Death, I think, rides a pale horse.
The plague?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, pale horse, yeah.
Was the plague or just
sure.
death?
I'm not sure.
I think just death is.
Yeah, so there could be a biblical thing there, but I think that that's more of what Lynch does, which he sticks a couple of elements in every show that will be built on in further shows.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? It's always
yeah.
A few things solved, and then new mysteries come in. So I wouldn't want to say what the horse is right now. I think I know, but I want to illustrate my problems here in relation to Twin Peaks. Can you hang on the line and listen?
Yeah.
Okay, to explain this, you got the next tape in, Doug, ready?
Mm-hmm.
And
you want to go to
let
it
me
right
see.
Now,
no, let me just think for a second how to lead into this. There's an interview for Mondo 2000 magazine. Gerald interviewed me, and it's called "The Greatest Artist Alive Today." And this was done in the summer, okay, summer of 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And in the last page of the interview, Jerry's asking me, what will be the image of Bob? Will there need to be a visual image? And then he said, obviously you won't look like Stang's cartoon image, you know, the pink version of the Bob head, which is in the Book of the Subgenius. Everybody
right.
knows that image. He knows that I am not that image. So he asked me, what is the image of Bob? And so I said, well, the user is the content. And then I got a little more specific. I said, did you ever read Tom Robbins' book, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues? Okay, you haven't, but I'm asking that in this interview, talking to Jerry, and I say in that book, in his preface, he talks about the original first amoeba, the original parasite riding through all of evolution. I say, that's Bob, the original parasite riding through all of evolution. And I say, that's me. And I say, I have slack. Bob has slack. And I say, Bob was the original amoeba, and he's the new amoeba. He's the one who gets the credit while riding on everyone else's back. I'm not an antichrist who tries, or an anti-Bob who tries to get the credit while breaking backs. I have such slack that I can ride everybody's back and take nobody's slack away. The techno environments, or media archetypes, are taking your slack away. This is what I'm saying to Jerry and to the audience for this magazine. I'm saying the techno environments are taking your slack away. They did it all through history. So Bob's here, I'm here to loosen it up so that the real effect of these techno environments, which was the real effect of them was to create slack, will be engendered. I'm here to engender that slack that the technical environments are providing for us. All right? So basically, I define myself as an amoeba and the original parasite riding through all of evolution. The key word is parasite. So I'm going to play you an excerpt from Twin Peaks 2 weeks ago when they finally got a hold of One Arm Mike and got him into trance, right?
Mike and Bob.
Beg your pardon?
Mike and Bob. There is a sort of parallel there between the relationship between Mike and Bob on Twin Peaks and Mike and Bob on the church.
Yeah, I've talked about that since last August. Yeah, and you have the little Mikey and little Bobby, which is Bobby Briggs and Mike, his buddy, who disappeared from the show for most of the last 10 shows. Remember that? His buddy who was in the show Saturday night, he came to look at Leo?
No. I haven't seen every episode.
Did you see last week's?
Yeah.
Okay, remember when they came, Bobby and them came with the boot?
I'm not sure. No, I didn't.
Bobby and the blonde guy.
Right.
They came and they cut open the boot and found a little tape.
I didn't see that part.
That was a key scene. Okay, well, the Mike that was with him is his young high school friend who was Donna's former boyfriend. He skipped out of the drug dealing that Leo and Bobby Briggs were involved in way back there. So he parallels, like a twin double plot, he parallels the fact that the older Mike has defected from Bob, all right? Just like he killed with Bob the first time, but he wouldn't do it again. And Bob vowed to kill again, but Mike didn't want to do it again. It's the same parallel with the little Mikey guy who won't do the drug dealing anymore way back at the beginning of the series. And he's only come back now.
Yeah, but...
So yeah, you're right about the Mike and Bob parallel that refers to this show.
But also that Laura's father and his alter ego is Bob, it seems, in the...
Okay,
stay on the line.
We'll get to that point after we play this tape, because you'll see Mike is describing Bob here, and note the word parasite as you hear this description, all right?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just listen.
You spoke to me in my dream about Bob. He was my familiar. Where did Bob come from? That cannot be revealed. What does Bob want? He is Bob. He is for fun. He wears a smile. Everybody run. Do you understand the parasite? It attaches itself to a life form and feeds. Bob requires a human host. He feeds on fear and the pleasures. They are his children. I am similar to Bob. We once were partners.
Hey, Tim?
Well, it suggests to me that maybe Bob is being set up by the conspiracy in some way.
Good point. You mean me?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That's a very, very good point, Tim. You see, it's really important that we deal with the punchline of the Great Northern Hotel because I'm sitting with Doug here. The church in Dallas, the Reverend Ivan Stang, his real name is Doug St. Clair. You get the Gnostic British Holy Blood, Holy Grail in his name. And we parody that by having Connie's Doctor for Bob Institute on St. Clair Avenue. But his first name, Doug, is echoed here by my understudy, Bobby Jr., Doug, all right? So you get Bob and Doug. And we know that in the 80s, the Bob and Doug archetype before you and I arrived, Doug, was...
It was the McKenzie brothers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Great White North.
And also my previous partner on the radio, Bob Esplin.
Of course.
Oh, was Bob who?
Bob Esplin.
So you had a Bob and Doug show before?
Oh, yeah, we used to be on Saturday afternoons.
So that's
the import show together?
Yeah.
When the station started?
Yeah, so that's like you're like little Bobby and little Mikey paralleling the exalted state you arrived at here.
We were the opposite of the Bob and Doug McKenzie brother archetype. They were the hosers and from the suburbs, and we were the intellectuals from the suburbs.
Okay, so the point is that the Great White North was the name of Bob and Doug McKenzie's show, right? That's the Great Northern. Now, that's Canada. To most of the world, Canada is the Great Northern Hotel, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that's the...
Inhabited by different souls every night.
The sort of socialist legacy of Trudeau or something like that.
Well, it's the Great White North is the Anglo-Saxon oligarchy. What we were talking about earlier in the show... you see, now that the East-West conflict has been put aside, we now have a North-South conflict, where the Northern Anglo-American, Anglo-Saxon, Great Northern oligarchy, you know, Scandinavia, Denmark, Britain, Canada, the United States, wage war and regional conflicts against the Southern empires. Southern, what do you want to call them? What?
Manifest destiny.
Yeah. The Southern, what? What do we call it? Southern peoples,
mm-hmm.
Southern differences, all right? So you see, Lynch here is talking about Bob's agenda here, and he's talking about Satan, or an evil element, it's presented as, is in the Great Northern part of the planet. Now, Toronto, if you read an article and poem put out by Robert O'Driscoll called NATO and Warsaw Pact Are One, he talks about the beast, the Catholic beast versus the Celtic beast. But he says the Catholic beast is in Toronto. And he says that the NATO used its, so we say, space shuttle, computer sophistication, solar level of military application. That computer was housed in the University of Toronto. And that's apparently a scandal for certain professors there, how the U of T's budget, University of Toronto's budget, has been siphoned off into this amazing NATO-NASA computer, all right? So that's, some people think the beast is here in Toronto. So you see, Lynch is referring to what I'm talking about. I claim that Toronto is the head of the solar government, and it's me and the anti-Bob here in Toronto, right? Okay, now you notice that he talked, the guy defined Bob as a parasite back there. You heard that, right?
Yes.
Now, that just came out 2 weeks ago, and I described Bob as parasite this summer, so I think I'm a bit ahead of Dave on this point, right? Or I'm anticipating his concepts, okay? Now that gets to the next point about Leland. Maybe, Doug, you put the next tape in. The relationship between Bob and Leland is the key here, that because what you just heard is that the Mike is saying to Agent Cooper that the magician longs for one chance out between two worlds, all right? Between two worlds is the interval. What is the nature of the interval? Well, I've been talking about the physical interval has been expressed as an environment in the tactile television and computer and satellite world. Basically, electricity is the tactile medium, all right? Now, that's the tactile is defined as the... a medium, the sense that interplays all the other senses. So it's the interval medium. So the interval is the key point. And so the traditional Gnostic dream or whatever wizardry is in our past, their dream was to get that glance, that glimmer of eternity as defined between two worlds, right? The interval. So again, Lynch is following along in Bob's concept and perceptual agenda here. Now, I think maybe... I want to prove that I knew who Bob was all along, and why didn't I tell anybody that it was Leland? I don't want to say that I was talking to Lynch privately, but I want to show you that there was a clue in the first eight shows. There was a clue in the first series right there where Lynch told us who Bob was, that it was Leland, and we're going to play that in a minute. But the I don't want to say that I got access to the script or whatever beforehand. I just want to say that I knew, and I can claim that I knew just from observing the series as it was televised. But I didn't tell anybody because I wanted to exercise an anti-environment to my own dilemma, which is being a know-it-all, all right? And if you know it all, then, of course, you have a yearning to tell everybody. But I thought, well, I knew what the hidden ground here was in Bob in relationship with Laura's father. But I practice a personal yoga myself and practice being humble and keeping it to myself. So that's the yoga I've been doing for the last 6 months. But anybody could have seen it. And if we get it ready, this is the cassette from Agent Cooper's Diane series. You know, you can buy the cassette of his messages to Diane. And you got side two on, Doug? All right, so stay on the line, Tim, and let's listen to the clue. It's right there for us to hear in this excerpt from the series about the middle of the series. It's at the point when they discover the cabin and Waldo, and they take Waldo back to the police station, and then Waldo is assassinated. You know who Waldo is, Tim?
I think in terms of visual images rather than...
Waldo was the parrot.
The parrot?
Yeah, remember the parrot in the first series?
The introductory episode, whatever.
No, in the middle.
The bird they take to the police station that ends up getting shot by Leo.
No, I don't remember.
And drips all over the donuts.
Right. Do you remember when they go to the cabin and the music is the place where the music never stops and the record player is going constantly? You didn't see that show?
No.
Okay. Well, what you're going to hear is Waldo talking that they recorded on tape before he was assassinated. All right. Okay, here we go.
Diane, what you are about to hear is deeply disturbing.
Laura? Laura? Don't go there. Hurting me. Hurting me. Stop it. Stop it.
That was the last entry Waldo the Miner made. A bullet entering from outside the station ended his shiny-eyed, beaked, and feathered life. Deputy Hawk gave chase, but was unable to apprehend Waldo's killer. It is possible that whoever assassinated Waldo is the killer of Laura Palmer.
Okay, Doug, can you just rewind that? Did you hear what I heard? Did you hear it?
Yeah.
I heard it.
Leland, no.
Yeah, not Leo.
Yeah.
What?
Leo or Leland?
It sounded like Leland.
It's Leland when you know it's Leland having now. But at that time, Leo was the main suspect presented to the viewer, mm-hmm. and everybody heard it as Leo. Mm-hmm. But it's right there. You could hear it, Leland. And, of course, I knew what was happening, so I could hear it as Leland, so I kept it to myself.
You actually pay attention when you're listening.
Yeah. I can look and listen because I'm tactile. You know, with intensity. Mm-hmm. You want to just replay that for skeptics in the audience? No, just that little, just go back a bit and we'll play when the... Is a minor bird a parrot? Same family or what?
No, I think it's just a mimic.
Okay, well, we'll say this isn't a parrot, this is
like a... Darling.
I'll see.
What?
It's like a starling.
That was the last entry.
Okay. Yeah, but Tim, you heard it as Leland. If you listen for that, it's very clever the way Lynch knew you'd hear Leo, but the way the land comes in there. If once you know that, the user is the content. So the important thing is Leland has followed Leo and Jacques Renault and Laura and Ronette, I think her name is, up to the cabin. He's watching them because the log lady heard the third man go by after the first four went up there. So Leland's watching. Now, Jacques and Leo get in a fight. Jacques and Leo get in a fight, and Jacques collapses outside, He wakes up later and the place is empty. So he's assumed Leo and the two girls have gone. So what you can imagine happened is that Leo left for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you remember the vision in the first show, I think it's the first show of the second series, you see Ronette's vision where she sees Bob come. No, you see the fact that Bob comes into the train, the abandoned mm-hmm. train, and does something to Laura and supposedly kills her, right?
And tries to kill Ronette.
Yeah, that whole scene, you see that in Ronette's memory when she starts to wake up, and I think that's in the first show of the mm-hmm. second series, right? Now, what you have here is they've been taken from the cabin, right? So the Minor Bird is the Minor Bird didn't go to the train. The Minor Bird is picking up the conversation when Leland shows up after Leo and Jacques are gone,
mm-hmm.
Jacques being unconscious and Leo's gone, and so the first words are spoken by Leland, I would say. He's going, Laura, don't go. Laura, don't something, right? So it's Leland talking to his daughter mm-hmm. when he sees her tied up. She's tied up there.
Yeah.
And then we don't know if he's turned into Bob at that point, but he's starting to do something to Laura and take her to the train.
Mm-hmm.
And so she says, you're hurting me. Stop, you're hurting me. Leland, you're hurting me. So whatever he was doing to her in taking her out of the cabin to the train is what the Minor Bird is communicating. All right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Makes sense? All right.
So also, I mean, it means her relationship with her father was other than, not, I don't think a lot of, it changed now, but calling her father by his name as opposed to father.
I think she would call him, she had a sense of maturity in herself, right? She's mm-hmm. precocious. I think she would call her father, in the diary she calls him dad, I think, but I can see her calling him Leland by that point.
Mm-hmm.
And also it echoes what happened when Leland attacks Maddie, you know, last Saturday night,
mm-hmm.
is that Leland is himself plus Bob, and he's oscillating back and mm-hmm. forth, and he's holding on to Maddie in the murder scene as if he can't control himself and he wishes he could.
Mm-hmm.
And he's seeing Maddie as Laura, and he is Bob. Laura can see Bob sometimes, just like I assume Maddie saw the Bob image as well as Leland. So she, at that point, is just seeing Leland when the bird is mimicking. You know, I don't know if she sees Bob at that point in his head, but or in his appearance. The question in the diary is that she doesn't seem to realize as a young girl through her life that that Bob is her father. But maybe I think that Bob is not her father. He's a familiar, as Mike explained. A familiar is a demon.
But Mike in that thing says he's my familiar.
Yeah. Well, what you have is a familiar is an attendant demon that attaches itself to a witch. That's a technical term.
But then who's, is Leland the witch? No.
Bob is a familiar. He's a demon that attaches himself to a witch. Mike, if Mike is dead, and if Philip Gerard, the host for Mike, is not a schizophrenic or multiple personality disorder victim, mm-hmm. and Mike is actually a spirit, then Mike, when he lived in this dimension as a body, and you know, he's now dead and he's speaking through Philip Gerard, when he was alive on the planet, he was a magician, a wizard, who longed for that look between two worlds. And being a wizard or a witch, the demon Bob attached himself to the Mike guy, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now Mike knows he's a split from Bob. He knows who Bob has attached himself. Now, we know that Leland, when he was a young boy, 10 years old, say, experienced Bob as external to himself,
mm-hmm.
and that Bob threw matches at him.
Yeah.
So is it necessary for Bob, who has his agenda, to attach himself to the father before he gets fully involved with the daughter? Or is Leland kind of a wizard himself and had that occult inclination, and Bob has attached himself to him, and he's doing an experiment with Bob on his daughter, or he's unwittingly being used by Bob as a familiar of Leland to attach himself to mm-hmm. Laura? But Laura sees, as a budding young psychic person, a young witch, you could say, you know, precocious in those areas, you can see her interpreting Bob as a familiar, even though she wouldn't call it that term.
Mm-hmm.
To her, Bob is something separate from her father. So the big question is how is Lynch going to explain and define his definition of spiritual psychic reality as opposed to the physical? Is he going to have it split? And is he going to involve the electric environment, which is his logo at the end of the series, mm-hmm. you know, the sparky, sparky, sprack, which is, what did you say, Doug, it's like?
The synapses snapping on the viewer.
Central nervous system synaptic connections breaking or connecting, communicating. So The interesting thing is that a common image in David Lynch's paintings is an image he calls the electric baby. So he is using...
this figure floating.
Yeah, floating, the discarnate man. So I'm really curious if he's going to really point this whole series to me, the expert on discarnatehood, and he is consciously or unconsciously been monitoring me, or he just picks it up as a genuine subgenius and is communicating it, because this is the question which we have to see unfold, is we're now watching, we've reached a plateau, we're now watching how Lynch is going to explain psychic reality, when I've explained over 3 years ago that the astral plane now joins in with the physical plane, because the astral plane, or the universal government, and the physical world merge inside the electric vortex. See, there's the question, the hidden ground for the reason channeling took over as a theme in many people's lives in the 70s and 80s was the breaking through of the universal government into the astral plane, into the physical dimension. And so this is percept, the actual situation we live in, and we want to see if Lynch expresses the effects and causes in his chosen medium, the TV soap opera.
Well, what do you think of the phenomenon of Elvis appearing in his latest movie, Wild at Heart? The persona Elvis seems to be, and Marilyn as well seems to.
Well, see, that is a reference to my perfect pitch charts. You probably don't have the perfect pitch. I didn't give it to you when you were down here. But in my executive newsletter called The Perfect Pitch, I mention the role of Elvis as a key image in the 50s. If I just get it out here, this is the chart that's in the High Weirdness by Mail book. You'll see that the global village arrives until the 30s and 40s, and then from 1945 on, we're into a global theater situation. And the first ground of the 40s and 50s is television. And you have the popular art form are Elvis and Fellini. They turn the technological art form of radio and movies into figures inside the ground of television. And the highbrow art form in that period is existentialism. The popular archetype, in the sense that the user of this television environment feels he's a monarch of, he feels he's a monarch of the nation. The city becomes a ghetto dropout, and the symptoms are paranoia expressed in America as McCarthyism. All right, so that's how the chart goes here. So obviously Elvis is an appropriate figure resonating with the television image. Elvis the pelvis. You see, television gets you in the gut. It's a tactile proprioceptive medium. And so the key sensitive area that Elvis expressed in music was the shaking of his pelvis, all right? So the fact he was expressing kinetic and tactile space on the TV medium, but his medium of choice was radio, all right? But he was a radio symptom as art form, expressing the hidden ground and sensory bias of television. All right, so that's why Elvis was an important long-range archetype and icon that's going to have staying power, because he was the figure for the interplay between television and radio and movies.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember Elvis being through his films, and
so
he always seemed to be this kind of symbolic of niceness and of generosity and things like that. That squeaky clean image seems to...
Well, that's the American...
persona.
Yeah, that was the radio... See, he's a radio figure. Radio is an acoustic medium, but it has a visual effect. That's why America went into a cleanliness syndrome, say from the 30s to the 60s, because that was the visualizing effect of the acoustic medium of radio, which was a voice in high definition. The oral experience in high definition had a visual effect, therefore represented abstract space as a fetish. So America got into a cleanliness problem, a cleanliness fetish, and of course Elvis being a projection of the American environment, which was becoming a world environment content-wise.
That wasp image, I think.
Yeah, well, the American environment was becoming a world environment content-wise in the 50s. So Elvis, he could dominate because he had the American money behind him. But also, it's not just the money thing. You know, he had Elvis was a major military operation with Colonel Parker, right? But you can't just inflict an image on the population. There has to be a preparation and a feeling for it in the population's bias itself. So the whole world was hypnotized with America at that point because it won the war. All right, so it was an ideal dream. Obsolete, but because it was obsolete, it worked.
Right. Well, the fact that he recorded for Sun Records seems to fall through to the solar government.
Yeah, good point.
And also the fact that the military operation that he did joined the military.
Yeah.
When John Lennon apparently said that's when they killed him. Not 1977, but when he joined the Army.
Yeah, that's what happened. So now there was something about Bob. Did we finish?
Is that then Muhammad Ali not joining the army? Then was that? Did he know something was going to happen?
Well, in the
I mean, he was someone who was being raised as one thing and decided that wasn't what he was going to be, and he was going to be a black man.
Okay, now in the 50s, the American dream is obsolete and it's working. In the 60s, the American dream doesn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's obsolete, period.
Yeah, you have the beatniks as the interval from the 50s to the 60s. So in the 60s, you have the computer as the hidden ground. Therefore, in the early 60s, black and white TV becomes art form. And in the latter 60s, you have color TV as an art form. In the first phase, you had Norman Mailer as the highbrow art form and the Beatles as the lowbrow popular art form. Mm-hmm. And the lowbrow art form of the color TV phase in the later 60s is psychedelia, and the highbrow artist of that was Marsh McLuhan. Now, the point is television, as a figure, prefers the black image more than the white image. The white image is anemic on television. Now, television is a hidden ground in the 50s, so you're looking for a radio movie image. That's cleaned up. That's Elvis. And so the black image rules in the 60s and provides an ersatz, fake anti-environment, therefore the role of Muhammad Ali, rejects the military operation as a fake anti-environment.
It's interesting you bring up the Beats, too, because the Beats are trying to recapture someone like the Islamic poets, like, say, Omar Khayyam, or the Persian poets, who, if my understanding is correct, a lot of them were existing in Islamic culture, and then the radical blacks embraced Islam.
Yeah, because, see, in a previous chart I gave out, Arabia was the resonant image due to a certain sensory bias, a certain element of tactility in the Middle East was a figure in the 40s and 50s. Mm-hmm. So you see the alienated print-oriented guys who are alienated by the TV image, they would look for a suitable cultural image which resonated with their new hidden bias. Even though they're print-oriented and poets, mm-hmm. they're affected by television, so they look for the Arabian image as the most recent image. Now, the hidden ground in the 60s, which became more popular as it unfolded, was China. China was the new hidden ground of the electric effect of television.
Communist China?
Maoist China.
Yeah, Maoist China.
And so people, POBs all over the world, the pink-oriented, print-oriented people, were very hip on the Maoist image for a long time in the 60s, because China was an expression of tactile man more than the Arabian image, and in the 20s it was the Russian image that had appeal.
Mm-hmm.
So these various countries take on prominence and preference in a fashionable kind of way as they resonate with the new technological dynamic. So Muhammad Ali does the opposite of Elvis because it was a different situation in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
He was charismatic because he knew that people did not want a military hardware existence. They were into temple bureaucracy, temple software world, and that was the beginning of the religious feeling and the counterculture and all the cults and the whole thing that came out of the late 60s. All right? The software effect, the need for a temple bureaucracy or a temple religious image, and that is now just becoming official. The pinks are just bringing that in. Well, that was the rise of fundamentalism in the late 70s. And all over the world, cultures became religious and had born-again figures in all different contexts. That was the solidification by the solar pinks and their media ecology of bringing in temple bureaucracy, all right? But it was already a popular feeling in the 60s. Okay, Doug, Tim, where did we go with this? Did we finish? So Bob is an interval. Now, you brought up Elvis. Did we finish the Bob thing?
I think we did. I'm just going to come over there and get a drink, Bob.
Yeah, you're fading? So, Tim, while Doug's doing that, you can talk some more.
Okay. You were mentioning the other week about the images of birds and of owls.
Oh, yeah.
Talking about the owl. And you were saying the owl is supposed to represent something. I think it's supposed to represent some sort of a inherent wisdom or something like that. That's like the anthropomorphic kind of way we view nature. And I was relating that to the fake robin scene in Blue Velvet and how that sort of it alienated me because it made me think of fake nature and Walt Disney and anthropomorphic visions and the kind of conspiracy style ecofascism of fake nature.
Yeah. And he opens up the dialectic between the bird and the factory in every show of Twin Peaks, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, okay, so the owls, now the owls are not what they seem. The angel or good alien or whatever he is, the white alien, has told Cooper through Bobby Briggs' father, right? The message they picked up, do you know that part of the show? See, the alien sent the military group that Bobby Briggs' father is involved in, they picked up a signal from from extraterrestrial communication form, which said, and it was a message for Cooper himself, which is a takeoff on Milton Cooper, who's running around celebrating UFOs right now and worrying and making us paranoid about aliens. But Cooper, Agent Cooper, he gets the message, the owls are not what they seem. I think that's the next thing to understand Bob. Can you hear me, Doug? You listen? Yeah. To understand Bob, we're now going to deal with the owl image, and probably the horse might resonate with that somehow. But we had a couple of listeners who did research on the owl image, and owl today refers to the Order of the White Lion, and they're servicing in the 90s, coming out of Las Vegas, according to someone who called in a few weeks ago. And also the owl traditionally is an image for the eye goddess and the female Isis goddess. All right? So there's a feminine right hemisphere angle to the owl. Now, I think the owls are some kind of surveillance because the term Ghostwood Estates, which is the development that Ben Horn's going to build, eh? I mean, Bob is obviously a ghost from the woods. In her diary, Laura refers to Bob coming from the woods all the time. She sees Bob as something in the woods, and we now know that from the diary and from this. If you read, if you listen to the tape cassette of Cooper's messages to Diane, he emphasizes near the end the sense of evil that's coming out of the woods. He can feel it because the Bookhouse boys have warned everybody about that, including Cooper. Now, note their Bookhouse, you know, that's print visual space, right? That's the American archetype. And they're worried about that acoustic, dark environment in the woods. So the owls are there. They're not what they seem. If there are actual physical extraterrestrial aliens involved, the owls may be doing surveillance on the woods or doing some experiment there, or they are renegade aliens Bob represents. Do you know what I mean?
Or it could be the Sasquatch.
I was also going to say shots where someone is being surveyed, as in the camera is being used as someone else's eyes, are always shot through bushes.
Yeah.
I mean, we're always looking at people, of course, but that's where we're the, you know, the fourth wall or whatever. But the shots where you are meant to think that this is someone peering in on someone are always shot through the trees.
Yeah, as if it's from the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and every now and then he'll do this image, which hasn't had much reference point, of flying over the trees.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's usually a daytime image, so I don't know if owls would... Do owls fly during the day? Apparently they sleep during the day, but anyways, this bird-like sensation of flying through the forest around Twin Peaks may be an evocation of the spiritual level of the owls, the psychic level.
And also, I think we were talking also a couple of nights ago about that spirits are usually moving at night. That's their rush hour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And India, you can go to India and hear that.
Yeah.
So also that one image that struck me, flowing over the trees and the trees, you know, moving in the wind. Could that be a UFO that was guiding? Because it was just thrown in and then there was no reference to what it was. But he puts that image in every now and then in, as an interval image. So, yeah, the owls are not what they seem. The owls are the next explanation of Bob that we're going to get. And that's what's interesting right now. And Harold Innes wrote an essay called Minerva's Owl, okay? That was his first essay in his famous book, The Bias of Communication, which Marsha McLuhan made much use of.
Who is Minerva, Bob?
Minerva was the goddess of wisdom, all right? So now remember, the wisdom, the old wisdom, is not what it seems. Gnostic, scientific, or psychic, the old traditional fake nature priest. The old temple bureaucracy is not the same because we're in a new situation which is has no reference points, and that's the real media ecology, the real wisdom. Now, the pinks will try to use the old wisdom as content, like ecofascism and environmentalism and nature worship, to representatives of the old wisdom. That's the question. See, these are questions that we have to watch David Lynch lay out for us, right? Okay, Tim, and...
I think there's another caller, Bob.
All right, so there was another... what were we just saying there, Tim? Was there something we were leading towards other than the owls?
No. The owl is... Well, it's nocturnal.
What?
But they have...
The owl is not what?
They're nocturnal, but they're highly visual, like human beings are, like primates are.
Oh, yeah, I didn't think... That's what I was telling you about. You say they're not kernel.
Nocturnal.
Oh, nocturnal.
Yeah.
Like humans?
No, but they're visual, like human beings, like most primates are.
Yeah, they're visual and night vision.
Right.
And in other words, if we're in the acoustic tactile space, which is darker than the light of the Gutenberg galaxy, the Marconi age is dark, a new dark age in the electric environment. The owls are the ones who can see in the acoustic dark caveman world, right, that we're in. I didn't finish the Innes point. So McLuhan made much out of Innes' first essay, Minerva's Owl. And in 1957, he put out his Explorations, a special issue that he wrote most of, and he makes a pun on it. He calls his first article Minerva's Howl. Okay. Now, in 57, 56 was when Ginsberg's beatnik pean came out called Howl. So he was making a reference to high culture in Innes and low culture Ginsberg, if you want to use mm-hmm. those divisions. And he called it Minerva's Howl. Now, that's a key phrase, Minerva's Howl, because the old wisdom is what we're witnessing now, the howl of the identity crisis of all former cultural archetypal wisdom structures, including Jungian patterns. All right? So that's the identity crisis. There is no new framework for the new wisdom. Okay, Tim, I think you got it.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay, go to the next caller.
Okay, Tim.
Yeah.
Hello.
Hello. Hi, Bob. I got the owl. That's a Minerva's owl thing?
Yeah.
Well, if it's Minerva's howl, it'd have to be a hoot, wouldn't it? It'd be like two-hoo, two-hoo.
Yeah.
So that would be like back to the man with no face split between east and west, who, right? W-H-O.
And with the two in there.
Two-who, two-who.
Yeah, so 22.
This is a clear indication of the anti-Bob, which is what I tried to tell you a couple of weeks ago.
Well, we haven't heard from you since October 10th or September 26th, because you missed fundraising, and you weren't October 31st. So, what were you trying to tell us? It might be hard to remember.
That the owl is the... That McLuhan wrote the introduction to the bias communication by Innes.
Yes.
And he takes a quote, Minerva's owl has flown to the darkening west.
Right.
Which is
to the darkening west. You see that? The darkening west.
Well, the sun comes up in the east, it goes down in the west, and then at twilight, the west darkens, you see.
Right, but
and
that
twilight,
also means...
Twilight comes before the dawn, and yet...
But remember, the electric environment is, see, that's the quote from Finnegan's Wake, ye shall have the night for morn. The west shall shake the east awake, but ye shall have the night for morn. We're going into an electric night. We've been in an electric night, yet we think in our Western bias that it's glorious for us, but it's going to be our doing in. So in that sense, I see the darkening of the west.
Well, the perspective of looking towards the west as a perspective of reawakening and freshness and vigor
yeah.
has been with us for a long time now. Whether that impulse was originally there, in the sense that the Greek culture embodies for us a lot of what came before, and what came before were the early civilizations of what we now call the Middle East, and indeed probably many surrounding civilizations that we know very little of. So it's a difficult thing to say just what the echo is that comes from there. But the idea that the movement was to the west is an important idea because the movement through Italy, the Roman Empire, and into Europe, and the constant conditioning of the Roman legal system, the Roman law, which was ancient in its own time, but it was destined to reverberate into the future, and it still reverberates and underpins most of our law today and many of our traditions. And I was thinking about media oligarchs. Earlier you were talking about oligarchs, and I asked myself the question, what happens if indeed we have like high interest rates now, that becomes a norm? Junk bonds in every country held at the highest level and at the lowest level. And if the electrical environment indeed does eat up money, eat up credit, what you do, you have a constant... evaporation, I think, is the way you put it, that there's an evaporation of the fact of spending power. But the stability between the different sources of spending power, that balance, represents the economic and the war economy also, the threat of that. And you can bring in physical environment, which is very important. The physical balance and harmony on the planet, now maintained as a status quo, this is a very important Eastern idea. The idea of consciously operating with this is a very important Western idea. And so that you could argue that the constant evaporation of the real spending power is becoming a necessity now, and is still becoming a necessity. I was thinking of when the barbarians from Northern Europe came down to Rome, as indeed they did about 500 BC, and when they broke into the very city itself, and so on and so forth. And this is before the Punic Wars, in which the Phoenicians and Carthaginians were finally put away. So at this time, the echoes of Greece, the echoes of Crete, the echoes of Phoenician culture in what we now know as Lebanon, and of course all the knowledge that was in those places of what had come before, Sumeria, Babylon, and for all we know, Persia, Tibet, and other places, all of that wisdom is still that the old Roman magistrates and elders sat in the central marketplace of Rome, and you'll remember this from your school, and they sat so still like statues that the savages, as they were called, the Iron Age barbarians from Northern Europe, walked around them and thought they were statues and pulled their beards to see if they could get a reaction from them and so on and so forth, right?
Yeah.
So the only way that these media oligarchs of their own time, who were already the bearers of paterfamilias, the notion of the entrenched father family that lay at the root of their law,
yeah,
and was destined to lie at the root of much law, right down to the present day, and indeed to condition the present world into its reality. All of that, these guys were naked, so to speak. They were old men, 60, 70, 80, 90 years old. Who knows how old they were in those days, perhaps only 40 or 50. But they were old men in their own time, and they were naked against the vigor of youth, the threat of swords, whatnot, spears. I don't believe they were killed, and I must say my memory fails me there, but I think that essentially their lives were spared. And this is a parable that's come down to us from our interpretation of the classics, and just that part of the classics which deals with history, not with the philosophy and the older parts. And it shows us the kind of choices that the media oligarchs will have in the present day, indeed, because what we need for the survival of the planet now is we need we need to understand what lies behind the great conspiracy, what the media archetypes, as you put it, indeed are, the cannibalistic archetypes.
Exactly.
But I don't believe that this has been really adequately dealt with in this discussion today, and I...
You mean tonight?
Well, that's correct.
Yeah.
I don't mean improperly dealt with. I just think that we really will have to get into it a lot more.
Well, I think you've helped by defining the pattern I was trying to deal with. That's the question we're dealing with, and you've just replayed it for us, so that's good. We might be able to work with that.
Oh, but there's much more than that. It comes back to Twin Peaks, Bob.
Yeah.
The in the first place, there's a number of things. One thing I'd like to clarify...
Okay, just before you go on... You know, you talk about the hope is in the west, but...
We have held that to be the truth.
Yeah, but isn't the sun come out of the east in the morning? Wouldn't there be a magical effect of the east, too?
Well, the Chinese have their national anthem, the east is red. I mean, to them, that says it all, and you can't ignore what they say.
Right, and so but we don't see the east when the sun comes up as...
It's not our national anthem, Bob.
Yeah.
Like, when you tell me the east is red, I go, right, that's the Chinese. It doesn't do it for me, you know what I'm saying?
So there's a definite split between east and west in interpreting the east and west.
No, the living human beings are the bearers of culture, and they're the only bearers of reality. Someone discussed movies earlier tonight, and of course it's phantom images. It's just, as you so nicely put it, movies are really nothing but photographs, and photographs are still, they're frozen moments in time.
Yeah, it's speeded up photography.
But they're phantoms. If you look with illuminated eyes, with the eyes of wisdom, which are the eyes of the owl too, incidentally, but if you...
Well, here's a quote for you. The movie medium is the phantom city faked of film folk. PH. Phantom City, fake to film folk.
But Bob, it's not genuine discorporate reality. That's the important
thing. No, not movies. No.
It's really a phantom imagery. If your eyes were fast, you would see between the frames. 16 frames a second, you'd need 32 to fool you.
Yeah, it's
if
dreamy.
If you took up Zen arts and yoga and trained your eyes to their maximum capability, that wouldn't be good enough.
See, that's dreaming. That's anthropomorphic dreaming. We're into something new where we're hallucinating, making sense. The movie era was the last dream awake. And now Finnegan's awake. Finnegan is a tribal entity, and the tribal effect of movies is awake, or post-dream hallucinating. Dreaming awake is, what's the word for it?
Well, but it's the living human beings that are the bearers of culture. So the question...
Culture is the human beings.
Pardon?
Culture is human beings.
That's right, but it's the living human beings that bear the culture only. So that if we in the Western civilization in the current that's been flowing for the last 100 years or so, or however long it's been flowing, we've been looking to the West. See, so the only point I'm making really is that image is stable, that it's a stable image, and the stability of it is maintained to the present day. Therefore, it's a channel across which understanding can come.
All right, so that's why the in the popular lingo, the capitalism won. The West dominates the East at this point as an image?
Well, I was thinking a little bit this way. The Sean Sutter pointed out earlier, he speculated that high-definition TV could be considered a new medium, and I don't agree with that at all. TV is the medium. Now, it may be that the digital control of the medium, the super-digital editing tools that are exemplified in the personal computer now, the ability to switch ultra-fast with great precision and high definition on that TV screen with satellite link-up, real-time hook-up, all that kind of stuff, it may be that the imagination itself has now become, I'm going to coin it, somewhat overted, if I could use that anomalous use, you know. The imagination itself has now become overted into the public simultaneous act of TV editing of news content real-time.
That's what I mean by media archetypes are the only occupants of the global theater. The public unconscious is now externalized in human extensions of these environments, as you just explained, on the public level of imagination.
Well, it may be, you see, if the media are the extensions of man, as McLuhan suggested, and stay with this that he said Minerva's owl had flown to the West, eh?
Yeah.
And that flight is a dynamic, and it indicates the life of the bird. And as I tried to indicate, the life of the wisdom. I tried to make the step connections. You know, you can step across 1,000 years to the Roman oligarchs in their square, and you can step another 1,000 years to the Masonic Lodge in the year 1100, and you can step another 1,000 years to now. But you can take those steps. Your real living imagination, based in your living body, it's real across that time as long as the conceptual structure you're using is stable. Now, time is going to wash away any conceptual structure. There's previous history of humans on this planet for which the conceptual structure has been utterly washed away by time. We'll simply never recover it. We have to see that. We'd have to get to outer space, something like the Scientologists with their, what do they call those creatures? Whatever. The so-called intelligences that supposedly devolved from the grammar of the universe itself. If indeed you could talk to such an intelligence, you might learn what humans came before. But in the meantime, we're stuck with the stable structure. So we have the dynamic of the owl, the bird flying. It indicates life. We have to look at life. And we look at the media today. And I'm saying that McLuhan can say that the media, as he explained them, were extensions of the senses of man. And he talked about the ear, the eye, the foot, the hand, the finger, the kinetic sense. But when we speculate today here now that the imagination itself maybe have become everted and exemplified somewhat in new media applications bordering on what? A digital computerized editing control of live media?
That's what you mean by HDV, high-definition TV, is not a new medium.
No,
it is
not.
A variation on the medium of television.
No,
so that it's an ersatz or fake anti-environment or fake left-hemisphere tuning, fine-tuning. That's what you're saying.
Well, what the people do with it is the focus of attention right now. But the high-definition TV itself is just it's just new hardware.
Yeah, it will create new fashions and new sensibilities, but they won't be as lasting. The electric eternity, the heliotropical no time, was established with television. As Marshall said, it was the end of creation. We had extended our central nervous system, and it included all the senses, so there we were.
Everything was implied from that point.
That's right.
And the fact of that implication was a new event, and we're still living with the results of that implication.
Okay, I want to hold you there. We got to play some Exa stuff. If you want to stay on and listen, and then we could talk about what you hear after you hear the tape. I'd say we've got about 6 minutes of tape to play. That's the next one, the Exa there. Let's just see, Doug, what you want to hold up. Should be a Maxell. Yeah, you got that in there? So you want to stay on the line? We're going to listen to the Exits on a couple of topics that might give us a
okay, the thing I wanted to leave with you was just the idea that it's very clear to me that this false Bob, the false identification of Bob from the lips of a dead bird that isn't really an owl at a time when the power of owls is evident in Twin Peaks, this false identification of Bob from a dead bird.
Good point, yeah. Leland is not Bob.
The anti-Bob that's being dealt with there, and there are misdirections in a satanic direction, and it's got a very Stephen King feel to it, what you say about the woods. But what I think really...
Have you watched Twin Peaks?
No, that's the beauty of it.
Okay.
I have to do all this with my third eye. I saw one episode 4 weeks ago, and that's it. That was the one where they had the karate fight in the restaurant.
Well, it's a good insight about the minor bird saying Leland, because Leland is not Bob. I mean, we don't know if Leland is the vehicle for killing Laura, but what really killed Laura is remains to be seen.
Well, Bob, what you said...
Just a minute, Doug wants to say something.
I was going to say, who's to say Bob does not manifest in a number of...
Yeah. Right.
If there's a witch's coven, who's to say Bob is not coming in all of them?
Yeah, because Laura says in the diary that she's going to tell all about Ben Horn. So Ben's relationship and the fact that Bob is in the Great Northern, it's an environment. Mm-hmm. That's the point.
Well, the fact that Laura is dead, the young girl killed. You see, this is a tragic event, and Minerva is the. Is a younger female image, which is why I thought it was important that the owl as it flew west was a living, indeed a living image, and that we could see the traces of this, on the stamp of it, on our very history, and we can see the life of it in the very fact of our culture today, and we can see the existence of the polarity, the other side, where it's coming from, in the very vigor of the Chinese national anthem today. It's all there, the life of it, and it's really the life of the young female. And in the I Ching, the youngest daughter, I believe, is the water sign, if I'm not mistaken. And water is what held to be the sign of the youngest daughter. So now by implication there, you have eldest, youngest, and middle daughter. You have earth, mother, sky father. These are all the images of the I Ching. And yet sky father was the image of the European barbarians with their sun worship.
Okay, we got to go. Then you can stay on the line if you want and listen to the exorcist.
You,
and then,
if you see where it's going, though, watch.
Well, I think
that
you've spelled out a schema here that we want to continue. So I hope you remember what you said.
I'm with it. I've got
because you're on the edge of some new questions.
Maybe.
Which I want to deal with.
Yeah.
Okay, so either stay on the line or you can hang up. But we got to play the exorcist now. I got some good exorcist stuff, short messages, different topics. All right, so you can hold on.
Yeah,
okay.
We'll
Okay, Doug, ready for the Exus? This was these are from January 20th, 1990, and I think it's all from January 1990. So this is almost a year old, this stuff.
One person has asked if there is going to be any medical breakthroughs this year and beyond this year as well. The medical field.
The entire medical field itself go through the considerable number of breakthroughs in this year. Multiple sclerosis is discovered and solutions applied to it. AIDS itself, by the end of 90, a sigh of relief because of not palliative but curative. In this year, 1990, more common diseases will be curable than at any other period in medical history. Name your favorite disease, and there will be considerable strides made in it in this year.
There's one other question here concerning some predictions made by, can we refer you to the books of Benjamin Krem? He's predicting, and this person would like some comments on this. Apparently this is of interest to many. On the second coming of Christ, living in the physical form in London, England, in the East Indian community, comments on the prediction that there will be a collapse of the stock market in Japan, followed by Christ announcing his presence to the world on television around the world. Can you comment on this?
That there will be ups and downs of the Tokyo market, yes. And that is the best we can discuss on that entire subject.
Thank you. Also, there has been a question concerning extraterrestrials, British Columbia or the rest of the world, 1990. Any contact or true information?
It would depend upon true information. But we assure you that the number of sightings of unidentified objects will be high in 1991-92, considerably higher. that that which is of the biggest interest to those who are interested in this field will be the revealing of data from the United States concerning certain materials that have been found but cannot be identified. That the United States, particularly the Air Force itself under their control, and also the National Security Agency and other security agencies, have been somewhat quiet in this, would be an understatement, but that it will be admitted in 19 that certain materials have been recovered to which there has not been a terrestrial or manufacture. That, they will say, is not proof. But the point is, proof does not come until, to its absolute proof, does not come until 94.
Is there any further information on how the free trade will be affecting all of us in BC this next year? And
neutrality, because of the this movement between Washington State and British Columbia, that this is not a political organization, but is an economic move, then it will prove very profitable that free trade exists. But this will not be experienced in eastern Canada, where certain industries will consider their movement south because of taxation, and the GST on top of taxation. The GST will, we assure you, be instituted, but it virtually guarantees that the Conservative Party itself will not be re-elected.
Do you have any final comment on or final statement this evening?
Canada is short of people. It would appear that there are too many. There are not. The country needs people. It does not matter whether they are this color, this religion, that religion, whatever. The country needs people. One of the greater problems in North America across the next 10 years is a growing problem that can be best described as neo-Nazism. Those who would say that there is not enough to go round, the pie is only this size, you take a slice, I do not. That concept. These, and there is no other word for them but fools, who would suggest do not listen. Because actively, they steal from your quality of life. Say no. And we do thank you.
Okay, we thank the X's for excerpts from their press conference on January 20th, 1990. As I don't know if you heard that, Doug, they predicted in January that the AIDS cure would be announced at the end of 1990, and we had that as an exclusive here during fundraising. And it looks like the AIDS cure will be announced officially in December, so fulfilling the X's prediction.
Oh,
what?
Just some brief curatorial things. Ken's opening the door. We have about 3 minutes left. There is another caller who's on hold.
Okay, we can take that. Ken's cool. Before we do that, just to review the Benjamin Crean. So we have the AIDS prediction. Are we on, Doug?
Yeah. Okay,
much good stuff happening medically this year, and Connie's directly involved with that. And then we have a message for David Ayer on the X's view of Benjamin Crean and the Maitreya syndrome. What was GST is going to come no matter what, but Mulroney will not be the next prime minister. Conservative Party is going to go down badly.
And the East will suffer in free trade, but the West will prosper.
A little bit better, yeah. And neo-Nazism, the May-Brussels scenario on the rise in the 90s for North America. So we got to deal with that. Okay, Doug, let's take the last call.
Okay.
Hello. I've been listening to the show for a couple of weeks now, well, a couple of months now, and I'm calling to talk about the ethnocentrism of the approach to the show.
Yeah, go ahead.
It just strikes me that a lot of the problems that people seem to have in explaining things would become a lot clearer. For example, if there was a recognition that there was civilizations and histories and knowledge pre-Roman, pre-Greek that were Egyptian, African. This never seems to be admitted.
No, I talk about that a lot when it comes up.
Well, I mean, for example, we just heard the last caller that you were talking to for such a long time saying, you know, well, there might have been civilizations other than the Greeks and Romans, but we don't know about them. Well, I mean, the fact is that the knowledge is there.
Well, that's that particular subgenius's view. It's not our church view here.
Pardon?
That's that particular subgenius's. He was a subgenius who called in about that. That's his view. It's not our view. That's his church. Well, his scenario. It doesn't mean we hold to it. We match with it. I mean, I've talked about ESP and Atlantean cultures and pre-alphabetic cultures many times. I'm an expert on the qualities of those cultures, on the African cultures, and the any other regions that are outside of the Western alphabetic stream.
And, well, I mean, perhaps I've just missed them in the last couple of months that I've been...
We've been on the air for 3.5 years.
I've been listening, and I was just called because I was particularly incensed by that caller's comments.
Well, what would you say to that person then? I mean, and clarify, would you say there are other cultures than his?
Well, I would say, for example, I'd say there are other cultures. I would say that, I don't know, I mean, a lot of this, the whole approach, this notion, for example, we talk about, you know, this corporate reality and what's happening with the electronic media, etc.
Yeah.
But it seems to me that, for example, minorities in the West have a completely different relationship to that electronic media. Into that reality that doesn't often get discussed.
Oh yeah, I talk about it. Yeah, you're saying the minorities in the West have a different relationship to the discarnate effect than the dominant majority.
Yeah,
I describe those conditions completely. I mean, basically, you're talking about an acoustic bias in the pre-alphabetic African cultures, and they respond differently to television than the alphabetic cultures, Nordic, Anglo-Saxon groupings. It's a little late to go into it, but if you listen in 2 weeks, I could talk about that in detail.
Well, maybe I'll call back in a couple of weeks when we have...
Yeah, we'll do that. We'll do that again.
More than a minute left, because I really have been a little concerned.
Okay, that's good. You can call in as soon as the show begins in 2 weeks, right after the phone messages, and we'll deal with that, all right?
Okay, I'll talk to you then.
Okay, thanks a lot, caller.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Sorry about that, but Kent has got a special coming up tonight, and he wants to get on the air. What is it, about 1 minute to two?
It's 1 minute after two, Bob.
Okay, so what we're going to end off with the hymn, and this hymn is dedicated to the white, maybe it isn't the white tradition. Anyways, this is dedicated to the revitalization of visual space, which we had several callers claim Lynn LaRouche does. Maybe the caller we just heard from will be willing to talk about Lynn LaRouche and his concepts, which many people in the black community find racist, non-white cultures, they don't like Lynn LaRouche, but there's a certain appreciation for Lynn LaRouche and some of the subgeniuses. And so for the people who left their comments and poetry on LaRouche, this song is for them. And thanks, Doug, for dropping in. You were great.
Anytime, Bob. It's been a great show.
It's been quiet and thoughtful. Thanks to you.
Okay.
This is CKLM88.1.
Someone to tell you everything. Sit around and wonder what tomorrow will bring. Maybe a diamond ring.
Well, it's all.